Tunisia's president says he's dismissed Prime Minister Hicham Mishishi and suspended parliament in a move the head of parliament says is unconstitutional. It follows nationwide protests over the handling of the coronavirus
pandemic. This
move
is deepening a months-long political crisis. The parliamentary speaker slammed the move as a coup and called on people to protest. But in the immediate aftermath of the announcement, those taking to the streets hailed the president's decision as long overdue.
About a decade ago, Tunisia was the birthplace of the so-called Arab Spring, when Tunisians toppled the decade-long dictator Ben Ali, heralding momentous change across North Africa and beyond. To some extent, the Tunisian experience seems to be an exception in the region, because the country didn't descend into the chaos and violence that have affected its neighboring countries since. However, many argue that the popular aspirations of the Tunisian people have been subverted, and their demands for dignity, national sovereignty, and social justice have been sidelined by the same disastrous economic policies that led the people to rise up and revolt in the first place. Fast forward to 25 July 2021. After a day of protests across the country, Tunisia's president Kais Saied announced that he was invoking Article 80 of the 2014 Constitution, which allows him to instate a state of emergency following an imminent threat. He sacked the prime minister, closed the parliament for 30 days, and revoked the immunity of members of parliament, and declared himself prosecutor general, all this while being backed by the military. The reactions were swift, especially from Western media and pundits. We saw headlines about the collapse of democracy in Tunisia, assertions that the coup is channeling the country towards dictatorship and turmoil. Saied has been described as a Trump-like populist and being inspired by the Egyptian scenario where Sisi orchestrated a coup after popular mobilizations in 2013, which pushed Egypt into a much worse form of dictatorship. We even saw some orientalist and racist stereotypes about the region, of the like that maybe Tunisians are not yet fit for democracy after all. Yet many in Tunisia were celebrating these developments, seeing them as corrective measures to the revolution and the burgeoning democracy. So, is this a coup or not? And if so, is it a military reactionary coup, or is it a progressive coup to correct the revolutionary process? Is this a useful question to ask? What are the dangers and opportunities emerging from such developments? And what would a progressive agenda look like in this context? Our guest, Haytham Ghesmi, is a Tunisian researcher and activist based in Tunis. His focus of work is around agrarian questions and land struggle. He currently works with the North African Food Sovereignty Network and hosts a podcast on Tunisian affairs called The Arrogant Monkey. Haytham is in conversation with Hamza Hamouchen, the coordinator of our North Africa program at TNI. This conversation is part of a series looking at the Arab uprisings a decade afterwards. Links to related webinars, publications, and other materials can be found in the podcast description. Hamza began by asking Haytham to put the events of 25 July in context.
So Haytham, let's dig in. Could you start giving us some context to what happened on 25th of July? Perhaps something on the immediate and medium-term climate, so we can place those events in their correct context.
Yeah. So in the month of July, in the beginning of the month of July, we witnessed like a lot of Facebook events of people that are not what we call famous activist people, who called for what they called the revolution of July 25th. Just to mention that July 25th is the national holiday of declaration of the Republic in Tunisia. So the symbolism of that day and the fact that it is a holiday and it's a Saturday make like a lot of talks about who are the people who are organizing these massive protests, what do they want, etc., etc. So on the 25th, it was a hot day. It's like 40 Celsius degrees in Tunis, at least in the capital. And we had like a lot of protests in many regions of Tunisia. that mainly attacked the locals of the Nahda party, which is the Islamist party in power since 2011 after the revolution. So these protests were not so violently attacked by the police. We're talking relatively here because there were attacks and there were, but relatively to what happened, for example, in January, where the police wasn't that much brutal against it. And in the night, we had the curfew, which is at 8 p.m. since like a month. The main streets became empty, and we have like a routine in Tunisia that the popular neighborhoods, they protest during the night after the curfew. So like we have, for example, big popular neighborhoods in the capital, like Hayt Tadhamun. People started to protest at 8:15 minutes p.m. or something like this. And at around 9 or 9:30, the president said that he's giving a word to the people. So he started with adopting the Article 80 of the Constitution, which postulates the state of emergency and that the parliament should be not really frozen, as he said, but it should work all days just to obey the state of emergency. And just after the declaration of the president that we were going to talk about further in the next questions, people came out to the streets with their cars and their fireworks, and there was the fiesta, at least in Tunis. This is what I witnessed with my bare eye. And in all around the regions of Tunisia, where I saw videos on social media, it's a festivity. It's been a long time, especially that Tunisian football team didn't get a lot of trophies lately. So that's what we saw, in especially in sport festivities. So that's what happened in the 25th of July after a short period of a movement in the social media. And we will talk later about what gave rise and what are the subjective and objective reasons for this 25th of July.
Haytham, you mentioned that people were rejoicing in celebrations after the decisions made by the president, Qais Saied. Can you explain to the listeners basically why? I know that Tunisia has been classified, at least by so many Western countries, including the UK, in the Western list for travel destinations because of the catastrophic COVID-19 crisis. And maybe you could also tell us a little bit about the political blockages or political power dynamics that led to this power grab or to this coup, as some people describe.
Yeah, sure. In fact, let me just put you in the context of a country that has, until July, 200,000 deaths by COVID-19 for a population of 11 million people. So, and
you mean 20,000 deaths or 200,000?
200,000 deaths, wow. Yes, sorry. Wow. For 11 million. And the thing is that, okay, this is a pandemic. Every country has its own strategy. For example, in the UK or in Sweden, they adopted the strategy of the herd immunity and things like that. Other countries, for example, like in the Eastern camp, they had like solid confinement and things like that. Okay, in Tunisia, and this is so objectively described, we didn't have measures, at least in 2021. The only measure we had is the curfew. That's the only thing we had during 2021. And we had, like, as they describe it, the specialists in Tunisia, we are enduring lately the fourth wave. So we can imagine that we have a country, we have a pandemic, which is worldwide, which is more than 1 year old in the whole world, and you have a government that doesn't do anything for it, just a curfew, just the security and the police measurement. And in the other hand also, okay, you can say you can live your life, but you have like a good health system. No, we had like a oxygen shortage for like 2 months for June and July. And we had like a lot of videos of people who are old people, especially who are literally thrown on the ground waiting for their place in the hospital. So it was catastrophic. And I think even in history, for the majority of peoples, health is like the last thing you can accept in a country or in a population, because the struggle, for example, for food, the struggle for employment, for the struggle for any struggle, it can wait and you have like alternatives for it. But I think health and death especially is a deal breaker. So that's what created this whole situation of anger, that in one hand, you don't make any measures to break the clusters of contagion. And in the other hand, you don't have I'm not going even to describe it as good or bad. We don't merely have a health system in Tunisia. So that's what made people angry.
Thanks, Haytham. Just to clarify, Haytham meant 20,000 deaths, not 200,000 deaths. So it is 20,000 deaths, but it is one of the highest per capita deaths from COVID-19 in the world. And Haytham eloquently described the catastrophic situation in the country right now. Let's move on to the Western coverage of the 25th July events. I think it has been terrible, not only decontextualized, but paternalist and liberal. There was such a fixation on the word coup and what it entails. We've seen some kind of mobilizations by Tunisians on social media to push back against this narrative, and I saw you doing the same on Twitter. Can you tell us how you and other Tunisians felt about some of the condescending reporting that tended to ignore sideline Tunisian voices themselves?
Yeah. In fact, I'm a huge MMA fan. And my best fighter is Nate Diaz. And when he won one famous battle, the first statement he said, "I'm not surprised." So in this case, I'm having a Twitter account just for one reason. It's an Anglophone Twitter account. And the only reason, and I'm saying that, stating that in my bio, I'm tweeting in English just to fight Orientalist and liberal rhetorics about Tunisia. So what I directly noticed that there's a huge problem of contextualizing. It's, I don't know, is it this liberal era of the end of history, as people say, or is it just laziness that people don't really put things in context? And that's a huge mathematical and philosophical problem. This is what I consider, because finally, mathematically speaking, the first thing you do before resolving an equation is to define its domain of definition, as we call it, which is the context. So, especially in the media, they're having like, it's a technical brochure, as we call it, or it's a technical recipe. Okay, we have a president, the president did this, okay, this is a coup. Okay, it might be a coup. Yeah, we can agree on that. But what's your justification for that? Is it Pavlovian or is it solid on real arguments? That's what I noticed in the first days. I am Tunisian and I follow the Tunisian political scene closely, and I follow the geopolitical news closely. And for like 2 or 3 days, I couldn't really define what was happening, because there are a lot of details and a lot of information around what was happening to build a definition or a description the night or the next day of what was happening. So yeah, we are not surprised by this coverage that can be explained, whether it's laziness or it's like the commodification of information, that the first person who says this will win more money. And that's our political and economic system in the world right now, unfortunately. And the second explanation can be just it's obeying agendas. And we really know that you can't do politics without agendas. It starts with an agenda and it goes until an ideology or a decision. So that's the problem that was happening with this Western coverage. And even for Arabic and Eastern and like African and Middle Eastern coverage, we had this condescendence and this speed to have like an opinion. It's not a race. I think it's not a race, but that's what really happened.
That's great, Haytham. I really like the way you framed it. And we are grateful to have you with us in order to deconstruct some of those decontextualized and, you know, even ignorant and lazy analysis as you described them. But now let's move away from the Western or the foreign coverage of those events to go to Tunisia itself. I know that there have been a lot of debates and discussions among Tunisians themselves, and there are disagreements till now, and people have different views. I know that some in Tunisia, including in the left and among some of our comrades, argued that the focus on whether it is a coup or not is a sterile and unproductive debate, and that we should focus on the material needs of the popular classes and working people. And some others welcomed Qais Saied's actions and described them as a correction to the revolution democracy, while some others were more cautious and conditionally supportive. We've seen other people and organizations that were adamant that what took place is a coup and sets a dangerous precedent and needs to be fought. So my question to you, Haytham, is where do you stand? What do you think about these varying positions and in the context of those celebrations of most Tunisians that you talked about on the 25th of July?
In the short story for me, I stand in what Vladimir Lenin once said, we can't cross the river with slogans, we cross it with boats. I'm not a Leninist myself, but that's a great quotation for me. Just to say that just giving and just being satisfied with the description of what was happening. And okay, the analysis, the reality analysis is important. But as another wise man said, that the German philosophy described the world, now it's time to change it. So that was Karl Marx. In a way, if you are a left political party or leftist thinking, I think we are more materialist than idealist in a way that, okay, this happened. It's even a philosophy of life, I guess. This happened. What are we going to do about it? It's so human and it resides in the fight or flight psychological system. We have three options. When, for example, you're going in the forest and there's a lion that crossed your way. First, you can freeze and don't do anything. You can run away, or you can fight it. Where are we? Are we just freezing and not understanding without any opinion? Are we just running away and saying, it's a lion, it's going to kill us, it's going to eat us? Or are we going to fight it? I position myself in the part of fighting in a way that even this is a good system, even if this was Fidel Castro. Okay, good for dismantling imperialism in Cuba, but okay, afterwards, what are we going to do? You see, so this is the passivity and the problem. For me, I'm having three or four group discussions right now just to do something towards what's happening on the short term, on the midterm, and on the long term. So I think we have, as I told you, the commodification of information. It goes from the news and journalism, and it goes also to the people who want to have like quick opinions, just so afterwards they will say, when things happen, they will say, I told you so. That's so infantile. Don't tell me I told you so. Tell me I'm telling you now so, and let's do something about it. For example, I'm going to be clear about it because this is the reality. Our Tunisian Labour Party, they said this is a coup and we are against the whole system and define the system and be against it effectively. It's not only about like communiques and opinions. They had the same thing with Ben Ali in 87, and they are like the purest politicians in Tunisia who predicted that Ben Ali would only give us 2 years of freedom, and afterwards in 89, he will become a dictator. Okay, what did you do about it? Okay, you're so clever to predict it. You are a prophet to predict it. Let's do something about it. Don't tell me I told you so. So yeah, in Tunisia right now, what's happening, it's a step forward. This is my personal opinion so far. And after like 2 weeks of the events that I developed after like 5 days, this is a good step forward, but we need to use it because finally, Qais Saied is not even socialist in the scientific way of definition of socialism. He's a good person, you see. He's a good person in a way that he prefers what's popular on what's elitist. He prefers, for example, even he has like a lot of symbolism. It's so idealistic. He hates injustice. He hates poverty. You see, he doesn't fight poverty, but he hates it. So what we need right now is to have like a program and a planning just to deliver to Qais Saied and to work on it, and especially to organize the popular movement that supports that.
I think we will come back to this, Haytham, a little later, around the program and the alternatives. Mm-hmm. I think I would agree with you around having positions and how to reflect those positions on the ground. So this is strategy and how to implement them on the ground. It's not just about saying this is a coup or not a coup. What do you do about it? How do we create alliance? But we'll come back to this a bit later. And yeah. I want just to deepen the conversation a little bit about this question, because you see it as a step forward. Others see it maybe differently. And in here, I would like to come back to the Egyptian example, because analogies and comparisons with other countries and contexts always have their limits. But at the same time, they can be full of lessons, right? In this regard, perhaps what happened in Egypt, 2013, with the coup, the military coup of Sisi, Algeria in the 90s, and even in Tunisia, you mentioned Ben Ali's coup against Bourguiba in 1987. So in the light of these examples, this pushes us to be a bit more vigilant and cautious in our assessment of the situation. So my question to you, like my direct question to you, Haytham, isn't there a risk that Qais Saied consolidates all power in himself or opens the doors to other authoritarian forces? Can we really give him a blank check, as some people suggested? Can he deliver on his promises of direct democracy? You say he's a good person and he believes in justice and so forth. But does he have that political and socio-economic program? I want you like to paint us a portrait of Qais and tell us more about him and if we should trust him or not.
Yeah, in fact, I would to stress always in the beginning of every answer or every conversation is that algebra is a good science. And it's an Arabic science, so we need to be good at it. In fact, comparisons, just to go back for two sentences about the comparison with the other countries and with Ben Ali coup, just to make the historical analysis coming to Qais Saied with his portrait. So Algeria and Egypt, they were liberated from the colonization by its military. So even popularly, people, they have trust in that entity. It's the military that made us a country, that made us a sovereign country. So every military coup is in a way welcomed just because it brings back this nostalgia. In Tunisia, what happened with Ben Ali is that he's from the police. Okay, it's still in the security, it's still having arms and having this force. But the question about all coups around the world is coups come from below to above. In Tunisia, the president, he was elected by 72% of the population who voted. It's like 2 million people. That's the most, the greatest number that a candidate had in Tunisia, even during dictatorship. So finally, what happened in Tunisia, that the person who is in power took more power. He's not above power like the military in Algeria or in Egypt, or as Ben Ali, when he was the prime minister of the president Bourguiba. So he wasn't, every coup here, they were below the power to go above. In fact, Qais Saied, personally, okay, let's take the personal before the political. He is that professor of law who speaks in classical Arabic in television. He's in his 60s. He has like a face that is calming, and he speaks so slowly, as I said, with Arabic, classical Arabic. He doesn't really debate violently. He doesn't, for example, cut the conversation on other people. And he was always trusted since 2011, especially by the youth of the revolution, what we call the youth of the revolution, this generation that I am a part of. I remember seeing him during the sit-in of El Qasba in 2011, that was against the transitional government that came just after Ben Ali was taken down. So, and afterwards, he was always coming rarely on TV just to give an opinion about big issues, like really big issues, especially on law, on the constitution when it was about to be written, after the constitution was published, etc., etc. And he was also in like a lot of protests and demonstrations with like what we call the big causes. For example, he was always in the protests of the wounded of the revolution that didn't take their reparations until now, and he was supporting this movement. He was in Manishim Samah, which was a huge national campaign against a law of reconciliation with corrupt businessmen that was proposed by the late president Beji Caid Sepsi. So he's there. You see, he's, as we call it, the son of the national state. In Tunisian, we call him Wild Baballa. We can translate it in he's the son of the door of God, which means he's so in the popular sphere. He takes public transportation. He studied in the public school, etc., etc. Afterwards, when he had his electoral campaign, as he always insists about it, he says it's not a campaign. It's not an electoral campaign. It's an explanatory campaign. I'm explaining a program. His program is that he wants to have what we call, what he calls direct democracy, which goes on that parliamentary democracy is not really representative, and the parties don't really respect and don't really respond to the demands of the people. So with his direct democracy, every small region that we call a delegation in Tunisia, it votes and it elects some people. These people go to a bigger assembly, which is the regional assembly in the governorate. And afterwards, these political assemblies and regional assemblies make a national one, which operates in a turning way that a person, a representative, doesn't take more than a year there, and they can be taken down every time they don't respect their region or their locality. So this is his main idea about governance. About economics, he suggested a program of reconciliation between two quotation notes with the corrupt businessmen who took loans and debts from the national banks. And he made like a list that the most corrupt businessmen does and executes developmental projects in the poorest delegation locality, which is the smallest repartition of Tunisia. So it's so technical. You can't find politics behind it. You can't identify it ideologically or identify it even philosophically. That's why I told you that he's a good person in a way that he has emotions against injustice and poverty. He doesn't really have a scientific-based political program. Finally, for your question, for me, you can't trust anyone in politics. This is a personal statement. Even we can't trust ourselves. We don't think the same way when we were like 20 years old, 30 years old, and even after. How are we supposed to trust other people who have like other conditions and other mental dynamics? And also there is a huge geopolitical problem in Tunisia. So for me, I don't trust him, but I don't trust him in a paranoid way. I don't trust him because I don't see results. And politics doesn't stop and history doesn't stop, even though he will make Tunisia a paradise. This paradise can be better. And there will be people who can take advantage of this paradise. There will be people who have problems with this paradise. So I don't want to take it to the emotional part of trust or not trust, fear and things like that. We are just going with him where it will take us. So,
Haytham, like just to push a little bit here. You're right. I think a good person might not be enough, especially when you're a politician, especially when you're holding power. He has been the president for 2 years now, right? He has been elected in 2019. And those ideas that you described, his ideas you described around direct democracy, participative and local assemblies and so on, sound great. I think if they can be implemented, it's great. But he has been in power for 2 years, and those promises have not materialized yet. Some people argue because he has been blocked by the prime minister that he sacked, by the parliament, there was infighting and so on. But for me, that's why I'm asking that question. Can he be trusted? Can we give him a blank check? A person, at least, this is my personal view, somebody who does not have a socio-economic program, and you say it's really hard to pin him down economically and ideologically, is a problem. And when it comes to reconciliation with the oligarchy and businessmen, that could be, you know, a red signal. What's going on there? Is he really gonna be pro-poor? Is he gonna really be pro-unemployed people in Tunisia? And I think this would take us to the other questions around the socio-economic questions, the socio-economic program, the socio-economic alternatives. And I think one of the fallacious assumptions of a lot of observers, including in the left, that led to those ill-informed assertions and analysis is the idea that what took place in Tunisia in the last decade after the downfall of Ben Ali regime is a kind of a democratic transition. According to this narrative, basically Tunisia has been functioning electoral democracy in a sea of chaos and military dictatorship in the region. So it would be great if you could tell us what you think about this discourse on Tunisia's exceptionalism in the region. And can you try to paint a picture of what took place in the last decade in your country?
Yeah. With the word of Tunisian exceptionalism, I have a huge problem with words that become so famous out of the sudden, like when our revolution was called the Jasmine Revolution. It was out from nowhere. Lately, we know that it was Frantz Fanfan who dubbed it like that. So the exceptionalism is a problem with two heads. It's a beast with two heads. The first one, it nourishes a lot of narcissism that makes us not really see the real picture, and that make it put us in a comfortable corner where we think, okay, we are exceptional. Okay, we can do this, we can do that. On the other hand, it's a hegemonic way of thinking, because the exceptionalism of Tunisia is the liberal democracy, and it's the steady implementation of neoliberal politics of privatization and of putting the state aside from its functions. So that's what's happening in Tunisia, saying that Tunisia is the only democracy in the MENA region on the Arab world, or et cetera, et cetera. What is already this definition of democracy? Because as much as I remember that Iraq had an experience in the 40s, Syria had an experience in the 50s, et cetera, et cetera. Even Mauritania, it has an experience. Like, man, there are these examples that we don't really know and you don't really talk about, and we feel so superior not to be compared to. So this is a huge problem in Tunisia after the revolution, that we had like a cultural hegemony saying that we are in the good path. It's a manipulation saying that Tunisia is having like good indicators in the freedom of trade and the freedom of, I don't know, economy and things like that, etc. So it's what we call the way to hell is paved with good intentions. In a way, it's paved with good slogans in this situation, in this context. So what we had in Tunisia during these 10 years is the democratic transition. It's transition from what to what? And it's according to what and to who? Okay, it's transition from a brutal system, which was the Ben Ali regime. But what were the slogans of the people during the protests? Did they listen to that? These think tanks and these international organizations? I don't remember. I was 19 during the revolution when I was like merely in every protest. I didn't hear anyone saying good governance, demanding good governance or transparency or these like good words with hidden intentions. They are good. For me, I want transparency. Okay, that's good. But the political definition, what we differ in the Islamic scholarity, the difference between the language and the context. We define notions linguistically and contextually. So linguistically, good governance is a great word. It's the best word you can have in politics. But contextually and politically, it's people of the South, do your calculation of your resources so we can take them easier. We don't need to quantify it and afterwards to take it. Do us a favor. So these 10 years exploded finally when we had tests like this pandemic. And this pandemic is doing like a huge examination for all humanity and for all political regimes in the world. You can have just a small glance on the map and watch which countries are really messed up with coronavirus. We can have an idea just by looking at a map. So finally, just to go back to your question, Kais Saied, okay, he's not Thomas Sankara. This is what I keep saying since he was elected, because I supported him during the elections. He's not Thomas Sankara, but he's the one who will open the door for more imagination, for more power to the people, for more symbolism. Because these 10 years we spent, which is a small period in any history of any people, but it was so concentrated and condensated with the technicalities and dealing with problems of Tunisia, just with laws and technical considerations. I remember, just excuse me for this example, because it made me so angry. During the protests of January, we had people on national TV analyzing the police brutality by the constitution, saying that according to this article, the policeman can't kill this person with a baton. Like, come on. Do you need a constitution just to say that policemen don't have to kill people who are peacefully protesting? This is the point where we got. Kais Saied is giving, hopefully, is giving another way of seeing politics. Yes.
You're talking specifically about the January protests earlier this year, 2021. Exactly. When how many people were arrested? Can you remind us?
1,500. This is the last update that I had.
Most of them are young people, right?
Yeah, young people from 14 to 25, this young. Yeah.
But this happened under just to be the devil's advocate, as they say. But this happened under Kais Saied's presidency, right?
Yeah.
So for me, there are some contradictions. Of course, it's good to manage contradictions, and the situations are always complicated. Mm-hmm. But I'll add some complexity to the question mm-hmm. by saying, okay, my question is, are there any signs that Qais Saied would be challenging those neoliberal policies or repressive measures or police brutality? You talked about, like, specifically about the neoliberal policies. Is he going to change the illegitimate debts? Just for the listeners, Tunisia's debts right now are more than 100% its GDP, and they come with harsh conditionalities that are implemented in austerity measures, undermining the public sector, like health. And that's the results. The pandemic that we see right now is the results of these austerity measures. Are there any signs that he's going to challenge those neoliberal dictates and repressive measures? Please go ahead.
Look, Qais Saied is not Thomas Sankara. I need to repeat it a lot of times just to say that he's not really challenging these neoliberal measures, but he's just doing the first kick or the first coup against what we call the liberal or capitalist realism. When, for example, in Tunisia, when we talk in the media about the debts, all the economic experts, what they say? They say, we can't do else. We can't do in any other way. We can't do otherwise, saying that we need to pay this debt. The whole discourse and the whole cultural hegemony in Tunisia is that the new liberal policies are the only good policies that can take us out of this crisis, without saying what caused this crisis. So, as I told you, with symbolism and with the imagination that Qais Saied is bringing right now, it can take us to a point where we reject these neoliberal policies and we can inject his policies as a population or people who are militants in the street or in the anywhere, to just push his measures towards these hard questions and these deep issues. And personally, I am more hopeful than pessimist about his acceptance of these demands in a way that, for example, during all his discourses since I knew him, not only after 2019 when he was elected president, I've never heard him say, for example, good governance or transparency, or even when he talks about corruption, he talks about it in a non-liberal way. So I think he's like a virgin territory to inject. And that's what I say in every meeting we had since July 25th with the groups of discussions, that we need to inject the technical with the political aspects. So there is some hope, but we need to work on it so hard, because the problem is not only a president who makes measures, but it's a struggle, finally.
You're right. Great answer, Haytham. I really hope you are right in your assessment of Qais Saied, but here we are here to discuss. We can disagree, we can have different opinions. The idea is just to shed some light and give a different perspective from the mainstream Western narrative around what's taking place in Tunisia. And in this regard, even including during my own fieldwork and visits to Tunisia in the last 5 to 6 years, I observed that the country has been a cauldron of resistance and mobilizations, demanding social and economic justice. And this has demonstrated the vacuity of the mainstream liberal discourse, which tends to separate the political from the economic. So I think it would be good here for our listeners to highlight some of these struggles in order to reveal some of the economic roots of Tunisia's predicament. So Haytham, yeah, you could mention a few struggles here so people can have an idea that the last 10 years were not just this democratic transition that people are talking about.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, this is a open heart suggestion to any political analyst or researcher or even someone who wants to write a book about Tunisia is the timeline of protests since the day Mohamed Bouazizi set fire on himself. Until today, we have a timeline that clarifies a lot how these liberal policies are not really adequate to these people. And it's the same, I think, to the whole region, to the whole global south. We can have this huge book or this huge encyclopedia of the timeline, historical timeline of protests. So in Tunisia, since 2011, okay, Ben Ali was gone. We had the first fight. I will do it quickly, okay? So we had the first fight against the first government that was the old regime in power. Afterwards, we had the fight for the military trials of the police people who killed the martyrs. And afterwards, we had like the struggle. This was in 2011. 2012, we had the struggle for the transitional justice for the martyrs and the wounded of the revolution. So in 2013, we had the problem of the assassinations. And in the other way, we started to have problems of resources management. Like we had like a shortage of domestic water in a lot of houses, in a lot of regions of Tunisia, including my original region, which is Gafsa in the southwest. Every summer when I go back to my parental house, I can't find the water. So in 2014, we had the elections. Okay, that's like a small pause. But afterwards, the president who was elected, which is Beji Caid Essebsi, proposed a law of reconciliation with the businessmen, saying that, okay, you didn't do anything. So Manish Musamah started. And I'm missing other protests because Manish Musamah started against this law until 2017. And during 2017, we had the protests in the far south, in the region of Kamour, against the petroleum companies, foreign companies. And in the same time, we had the famous Jimna fight for the land in the south. It was taken by the population and the farmers of the region. In 2018, we had like the fake corruption fight that we discovered that the head of government who was fighting corruption was a corrupt person. In 2019, we had the elections. Okay, that's a small pause. We had like, okay, Qais Saied is a good person. He's out of the box, et cetera, et cetera. 2020, we had the corona pandemic. 2021, we had the same January protests, the late January. We had like protests in the urban area where people are protesting development and their lively interests. And in the rural areas, we had like a lot of protests of farmers, mostly in every agricultural region in Tunisia. So there is no stability. And it's not what they call the hard giving birth or things like, no, it doesn't fit. Your politics don't fit. And people are protesting against it day and night, winter and summer. So this is the timeline for any researcher who needs to analyze how the liberal politics happened in Tunisia during this democratic transition decade.
Thanks, Haitham, for this timeline. I wish we had more time to go into depth and analyze each protest movement, each struggle, each mobilization. I know that every year there are tens to hundreds mobilizations and protests in the country, yeah, from the unemployed movement, from small-scale farmers, to women working in the textile industry, to unemployed graduates. I witnessed the Qarqna uprising just before it started when fishers,
yeah, were, exactly, I forgot about it.
Yeah, were complaining about, you know, the pollution by the oil industry. Yeah, and there are so many movements that show that things are alive and people are not just passive victims, but resisting those neoliberal policies that are dispossessing them. But let's come back to the coup, or maybe let's call it the power grab of 25th of July. I think it's important to place these events, Haitham, within a regional and international geopolitical context in order to better understand them. Can you tell us a bit about the reactions of Western imperialist powers and regional actors? And depending on those reactions, can it reveal something about the nature of the power grab? It's just a speculative question, Haytham. Go for it.
Yeah, it's a speculative one, and it's a hard one because geopolitics are so complicated and so unpredictable. But I think for me, from a historical way of thinking, I think the Mediterranean is taking its power back. Because as we know, it's been like two or three centuries since the Atlantic Ocean became the center of the world, because since the beginning, we had like always the Mediterranean as the center of the world. Finally, 2 years ago, we had like a lot of problems that became more resolved. Like, for example, the problem between Turkey and Egypt around Libya, the problems, for example, between the Gulf countries against Qatar, what we call the Gulf reconciliation that happened last year in Saudi Arabia. We have like a decline in the European power right now after the pandemic and the cohesion they're having after the Brexit and the coronavirus problem and the 2015 Greece crisis and things like that. The European Union is having like its most difficult times right now. So I think it was like a small window for this kind of power grab where these countries are not impulsive enough and hard enough, and you know, the same barbaric activity, Manta, of the especially of the NATO when there's a problem, whether they support a brutal coup like in Egypt or they for example they go against a revolution somewhere. So I think right now for the reaction of the U.S. Government, for example. It was a bit late. It was 1 day after, and it was about like we need to conserve democracy and things like that. It wasn't firm. As much as I watched or learned, there weren't no firm opposition or an enthusiastic support of what happened in Tunisia. Every country is saying, okay, let's wait and see. Let's wait and take advantage of this, let's wait and use it. So what's happening right now in Tunisia, I think, is the Mediterranean taking its power back, especially when we see the Algeria dialogues, the quick Algerian dialogues with and repetitive with the Tunisian government. And I analyze that it's just about the security, because, you know, we had an Islamist party in power, and we have like some fear of terrorism and things like that. And that's why, for example, we had the Egyptian intervention also and opinion saying we can help you against terrorism. On the other hand, we had like, I won't say the European because it's only the French and the German, because finally that's what the European Union is right now. It's just Germany and France. They are also not really firm. They're just, we need democracy to go back and Tunisians know what to do and things like that. So I think there's a small window that makes me extremely uncomfortable and extremely comfortable. For the uncomfortable side is that they can't be okay when it's not in their interests. I am speaking about the imperialist and the neo-imperialist powers. And what makes me comfortable here that geopolitically they are weak right now. Even, for example, for the U.S., it's losing a lot of wars right now, especially in Afghanistan and Iraq and places like this, Libya also. So, yeah, it's so speculative and it's so hard to tell, but it needs to be followed thoroughly just to be cautious about what's happening next and to be effective in suggestions and in resistance, etc.
Haytham, just to follow up on this, what was the reaction or the response by the United Arab Emirates, one of the Gulf regional powers? Because during the last decade, and even after the first wave, and even the second wave of the Arab uprisings in the region, Gulf countries intervened in different ways in those uprisings and those revolutions. Sometimes it's Saudi Arabia, sometimes it's the Emirates, sometimes it's Qatar. I think I followed a little bit after 25th of July that the United Arab Emirates expressed support to Qais Saied, and some even people were speculating that Emirates is behind the coup and it's not good news for Tunisia. So that's why I was asking that question, is to try to shed some light about what's happening regionally.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, the United Arab Emirates, it was in favor of the coup. It can't be hidden. But I don't think that, mathematically speaking, this takes us to the conclusion that the Emirates was behind it. Because, you see, this coup, this so-called coup, it didn't need any effort. It didn't need, for example, military effort. There wasn't no popular uprising against it. There was no other regional intervention just to make it not happen. There wasn't an internal military intervention just to prevent it, like it happened in Turkey in 2016, I guess, or something like this. So I don't think that there's a huge hand helping. Like you know, for example, when you're doing something that doesn't need means, you don't really need help. You see, because he had his constitution, he's the president, he can use that constitution. So maybe in the afterwards of this coup, there will be huge support to implement. There were promises, if this coup succeeds, the Emirates or other regional powers will support it financially or politically or internationally or geopolitically. But I don't really think, logically, that it was orchestrated by these countries.
No, I see what you mean. So can we just like understand this Emirati support to Qais Saied's decision because they are so hostile to the Muslim Brotherhood and their affiliates? Because one of the biggest losers of the recent developments, that power grab or the coup, is the Nahda, the Islamist party. So can we like understand it through this lens, Haytham?
Even for the Islamist party in Tunisia, it's not really the Muslim Brotherhood that we can see in Egypt, in Sudan, in Palestine, even in Syria before the revolution. You know, the hostility against it is not that huge from the United Arab Emirates. And in the other hand, also, there's another party who's opposing Nahda, which was also a victim of this coup, which is the Desturi Hur, the Free Desturian Party. And it is clearly supported by the UAE, but now it's a loser of this coup. So I don't want to really speculate about it because, you know, geopolitics is always tricky and you can't have like a final opinion about it. But right now, I think they will support it towards restoration, whether it's the Emirates camp or the Qatari camp, there will be restoration just as it happened in the revolution, because the revolution was made by the people, but it was restored by other powers, regional and international powers.
So Haytham, this will be my last question. This has been a great conversation. Just to come back to the analogy that you made at the start about the lion being frozen by the lion or running away or fighting the lion. So my question will be about how to fight that lion. What do you think are the urgent tasks of progressive activists and organizations in the current juncture? And what is the role of organized workers and civil society? Basically, what do you think should be done? Should we just leave it to Qais Saied and he can do it all on his own, or do we try to do other tasks and other stuff? And especially that you are a food sovereignty activist, it would be good to hear your thoughts about some of the alternatives as well.
Yeah, sure. In fact, with this with this lion, the first step of a confident person is to try to tame it, try to play with it, because this lion attack is not always like an attack to eat you or something, just to rationalize it. So we can tame it, we can even domesticate it. And if it becomes so violent to a way that it can be controlled, it will be fought ferociously. So this is the same analogy with Qais Saied right now. We need to take advantage with this small step of symbolism and of imagination. And exactly when it comes, for example, for food sovereignty and big causes like this, we need to have like a program, a real program, just to suggest it to him, at least to implement one seed or to go one step forward. So when he doesn't succeed this coup, or when he goes back on his back, or he does another violent step, we have at least a path where to start, or a door open just to enter or to break. So I think this goes with the huge work of preparing programs and plannings. And thank you for the example about the food sovereignty fight and cause. Qais Saied has like a huge hatred for monopolies and for big businessmen. And he always talks about the national security. And food sovereignty is a solution for the food security in its other definition. But it can be tamed, and it can be domesticated and restored to our benefit and to our ways of struggle. And that's what's happening right now in Tunisia, just waiting for when what they call the security measures take place. I think the building will be our only alternative, just to take advantage of what's happening.
So Haytham, what is exactly like happening right now? So there is a state of emergency for the next 30 days. And the president is trying to appoint a prime minister. Are there any other kind of pressures coming from trade unions, from civil society organization, pushing a political and socio-economic agenda? So it would be good to know a little about these things right now.
Yeah. Look, right now, for these 30 days, the first mission for Qais Saied and for this new system is to create like the administration for the programs and the plannings. He needs to have like ministers, he needs to have like a government and things like that. And that's what's happening. But for civil society actors, they understand that these 30 days, we just need the administration to execute. We need the executive power to execute these plannings. So everybody is just working on writing down and thinking about alternatives to suggest to the president.
Great. This has been a rich conversation, Haytham. Thanks a lot for having agreed to participate in this podcast.
Sure.
Atik Saha.
Aishk.
This is the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you for listening this far. This has been a conversation featuring Haytham Ghesmi, a Tunisian researcher and activist based in Tunis, and the coordinator of our North Africa program at TNI, Hamza Hamoshen. As of 26 August, Tunisian President Kais Saied has extended the suspension of parliament until further notice. Saied also extended the suspension of the immunity of members of parliament, and will give a speech to the nation soon. We wait to hear how this evolves further. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you, and see you next time.